Chris Pitaro had gone into scouting after an injury ended his playing career. When Billy called to tell him what he'd done, Pitaro was incredulous. When you're in the game, you always think something is going to break for you. No one gives up on that. I didn't. I was forced to retire. Billy chose to retire. And that was something I couldn't imagine. In the end, Billy Beane proved what he had been trying to say at least since he was 17 years old. He didn't want to play ball. With that, he concluded his fruitless argument with his talent. He decided that his talent was beside the point. How could you call it talent if it didn't lead to success? Baseball was a skill, or maybe it was a trick. Whatever it was, he hadn't played it very well. In his own mind, he ceased to be a guy who should have made it and became a guy upon whom had been heaped a lot of irrational hopes and dreams. He had reason to feel some distaste for baseball's mystical nature. He would soon be handed a weapon to destroy it. Sandy Alderson has a clear memory from earlier that spring of 1990 of Billy Beane taking batting practice. He didn't know much about Billy and wondered what kind of player he was. He was very undisciplined at the plate, Alderson said. Not a lot of power. I remember after I watched him very specifically asking, why is this guy even on the team? Not that it mattered. Tony La Russa was the A's manager, and in the great tradition of big-shot baseball managers, he paid only faint attention to what the GM had to say. That was one of the many things about baseball Alderson was determined to change. When Billy came to work inside the A's front office in 1993, he walked into the early stages of a fitful science experiment. When Alderson had been hired as the A's general manager a decade earlier, he'd been a complete outsider to baseball. This was rare. Most GMs start out as scouts and rise up through the baseball establishment. Alderson was an expensively educated San Francisco lawyer, Dartmouth College, Harvard Law School, with no experience of the game outside of a bit of time on school playing fields. He was also a former Marine Corps officer, and his self-presentation was much closer to former Marine Corps officer than fancy-pants lawyer. Sandy didn't know shit about baseball, says Harvey Dorfman, the baseball psychologist Alderson more or less invented. He was a neophyte, but he was a progressive thinker. And he wanted to understand how the game worked. He also had the capacity to instill fear in others. When Alderson entered the game, he wanted to get his mind around it, and he did. He concluded that everything from on-field strategies to player evaluation was better conducted by scientific investigation, hypotheses tested by analysis of historical statistical baseball data, then by reference to the collective wisdom of old baseball men. By analyzing baseball statistics, you could see through a lot of baseball nonsense. For instance, when baseball managers talked about scoring runs, they tended to focus on team batting average, but if you ran the analysis, you could see that the number of runs a team scored bore little relation to that team's batting average. It correlated much more exactly with a team's on-base and slugging percentages. A lot of the offensive tactics that made baseball managers famous, the bunt, the steal, the hit and run, could be proven to have been, in most situations, either pointless or self-defeating. I figured out that managers do all this shit because it is safe, said Alderson. They don't get criticized for it. He wasn't particularly facile with numbers, but he could understand them well enough to use their conclusions. I couldn't do a regressions analysis, he said, but I knew what one was, and the results of them made sense to me. Alderson hadn't set out to re-examine the premises of professional baseball, but he wound up doing it anyway. For a long stretch, his investigations were largely academic. You have to remember, he said, that there wasn't any evidence that any of this shit worked. And I had credibility problems. I didn't have a baseball background. The high payroll Oakland teams managed by Tony La Russa had done well enough in the late 1980s and early 1990s that Alderson felt he should defer to success. For more than a decade, he could afford to do this. Since the late 1970s, the A's had been owned by Walter A. Haas, Jr., who was, by instinct, more of a philanthropist than a businessman. Haas viewed professional baseball ownership as a kind of public trust and spent money on it accordingly. In 1991, the Oakland A's actually had the highest payroll in all of baseball. Haas was willing to lose millions to field a competitive team that would do Oakland proud, and he did. The A's had gone to the World Series three straight seasons from 1988 to 1990. Deferring to success became an untenable strategy in 1995 when Walter Haas died. His estate sold the team to a pair of Bay Area real estate developers, Steve Schott and Ken Hoffman, who were by instinct more businessmen than philanthropists. Schott and Hoffman wanted Alderson to continue running the team, but on a much tighter budget. "We had new owners who weren't going to spend any money," said Alderson. They made it clear that this had to be a business. "And so we suddenly were put in the position of, we can only afford a one-tool player. Which tool is it going to be?" What, and this is what the question amounted to, was the efficient way to spend money on baseball players? The first short answer, according to a pamphlet commissioned by Alderson, was to spend it on hitters. The pamphlet was written by a former aerospace engineer turned baseball writer, Eric Walker. Fielding, Walker wrote, was at most 5% of the game. The rest was pitching and offense, and while good pitchers are usually valued properly, good batters often are not. In Walker's words, "Analyzing baseball yields many numbers of interest and value, yet far and away, far, far and away, the most critical number in all of baseball is three. The three outs that define an inning. Until the third out, anything is possible. After it, nothing is. Anything that increases the offense's chances of making an out is bad. Anything that decreases it is good. And what is on-base percentage? Simply, yet exactly put, it is the probability that the batter will not make an out. When we state it that way, it becomes, or should become, crystal clear that the most important isolated, one-dimensional offensive statistic is the on-base percentage. It measures the probability that the batter will not be another step toward the end of the inning. Alderson's reference point for running an organization was the time he'd spent as an officer in the Marine Corps. He approached the A's farm teams the way the Marine Corps approached its boot camps. The individual star was less important than the organization as a whole, and the organization as a whole functioned well only if it was uniformly disciplined. Once he decided that hitting was the most important tool and everything else was secondary, Alderson set about implementing throughout the organization, with Marine Corps rigor, a uniform approach to hitting. The approach had three rules. 1. Every batter needs to behave like a leadoff man and adopt as his main goal getting on base. 2. Every batter should also possess the power to hit home runs, in part because home run power forced opposing pitchers to pitch more cautiously and led to walks and high on-base percentages. 3. To anyone with the natural gifts to become a professional baseball player, hitting was less a physical than a mental skill. Or at any rate, the aspects of hitting that could be taught were mental. By 1995, Alderson had created a new baseball corporate culture around a single baseball statistic, on-base percentage. Scoring runs was, in the new view, less an art or a talent than a process. If you made the process a routine, if you got every player doing his part on the production line, you could pay a lot less for runs than the going rate. Alderson was building a system with Marine Corps intolerance for exceptions to the rules. Sandy produced this long paper about the pros and cons of selective hitting, recalled Carl Kuhl, who was in charge of implementing Alderson's rules. He wanted to really push the kids coming up through the minor leagues. No one had ever heard of on-base percentage, but when you're being called to the major leagues depends on your on-base percentage, it gets your attention. The system's central tenet was, in Alderson's words, the system was the star. The reason the system works is that everyone buys into it. If they don't, there is a weakness in the system. the unacceptable vice in a minor league player was a taste for bad pitches. The most praiseworthy virtue was the willingness to take a base on balls. No player was eligible for minor league awards or was allowed to move up in the system unless he had at least one walk in every 10 at-bats. The effect of Sandy Alderson's new rules was interesting to anyone who believed the pitcher, not the hitter, was chiefly responsible for the base on balls. More or less overnight, all of the A's minor league teams began to lead their respective leagues in walks. To ensure they never lost that lead, Alderson routinely reviewed the batting statistics of the teams and leaned on managers whose teams were not walking. He noticed, for instance, that the Oakland AA affiliate was the exception in the organization. Its players weren't drawing walks at the same frantic rate as the A's other minor league teams. "I got my reports," he said. "I can see they aren't taking any walks." I called the manager and said, "They go up or you're fired." And they went up. Quickly. Even after the Marine Corps had come to the Oakland A's, there remained a weakness in the system. The major league team. The mere presence of a free-swinging light hitter like Billy Bean on the big club in 1990 proved that Alderson's views were not the controlling ones. Around the big league clubhouse, the GM trod more gingerly than around the minor league clubhouses. Alderson didn't march into Tony La Russa's office and tell him, "The walks go up or you're fired." No one did. There was no very good reason for this. It's just the way it was, because the guys who ran the front office typically had never played in the big leagues. The need to treat the big league team as the sacrosanct province of people who had played in the big leagues struck Alderson, who liked the idea of order and discipline cascading unimpeded from the top, as a kind of madness. "In what other business," he asked, "do you leave the fate of the organization to a middle manager?" But that is what the Oakland A's, along with the rest of Major League Baseball, had always done. Tony La Russa was a middle manager, and Tony La Russa had his own ideas about how to score runs, and those ideas guided the bats of his hitters. A player would come up through the A's farm system being told that he needed to be patient, that he needed to take his walks. And then the moment he got to the big club, he was told to unleash his natural aggression. Even players brainwashed by Alderson's minor league system in the new approach were susceptible to these arguments. Given the slightest opening, many of them regressed and began hacking away. "It may have something to do with how dominant these players are as they come up," said Alderson. "Patience and discipline at the plate has never been reinforced. They say they're not paying me to walk. And so if you don't lean on them, they don't." Before it had a chance to become a proper argument, the conflict between the old and the new baseball men was resolved by the budget crisis. Tony La Russa left when the new owners renounced the old habit of bankrolling millions of dollars in losses. Alderson set out to find a manager who would understand that he wasn't the boss, and landed upon the recently fired manager of the Houston Astros, Art Howe. "Art Howe was hired to implement the ideas of the front office, not his own," said Alderson. And that was new. Billy would say later that his wife left him because she was unnerved by his intensity, that she could even see it in his hands when he drove an automobile. At any rate, he soon found himself out of not only a baseball uniform, but a wife as well. Baseball marriages were like that. Their most vulnerable moment was immediately after a player retired, and it dawned on husband and wife that they'd actually be spending time together. "They end when the career ends," said Billy. "Until then, you can put up with anything because you're always leaving the next day." His wife moved back to San Diego and took their infant daughter, christened Casey, with her. Billy spent his weeks scouting and his weekends speeding down and then back up the highway between Oakland and San Diego. He couldn't afford the plane tickets. His motor was still fueled less by desire than anxieties, and he now had two of them. One was that he wouldn't know his own daughter. The other was that he wouldn't cut it in the front office. "If baseball's all you can do and you know that's all you can do," he said, "it breeds in you a certain creative desperation." When he wasn't speeding down some California highway, he was jetting around the country watching games and listening to the other scouts talk about players. Whatever shred of doubt he'd had that most of them had no idea what they were talking about, he lost. What he hadn't lost was his ferocious need to win. He had just transferred it to a different place, from playing to making decisions about players. But this time he had guidance, from a graduate of not one but two Ivy League colleges, and he was willing to follow it. What Billy figured out at some point, said Sandy Alderson, is that he wanted to be me more than he wanted to be Jose Canseco. In 1993, Alderson, impressed by the creative enthusiasm with which Billy seemed to attack every task he was given, brought him into the front office, made him his assistant, and told him his job was to go out and find undervalued minor league players. And then he handed Billy the pamphlet he'd commissioned from Eric Walker. When Billy read Walker's pamphlet, he experienced, well, he couldn't quite describe the excitement of it. It was the first thing I had ever read that tried to take an objective view of baseball, he said. Something that was different than just a lot of people's subjective opinions. I was still very subjective in my own thinking, but it made sense to me. It more than made sense to him. It explained him. The new outsider's view of baseball was all about exposing the illusions created by the insiders on the field. Billy Beane had himself been one of those illusions. Billy wasn't one to waste a lot of time worrying about whether he was motivated by a desire to succeed or the pursuit of truth. To his way of thinking, the question was academic, since the pursuit of truth was, suddenly, the key to success. He was bright. He had a natural, coruscating skepticism about baseball's traditional wisdom. He could see that Eric Walker's pamphlet was just the beginning of a radical and rational approach to the game, one which would concentrate unprecedented powers in the hands of the general manager. Where had Eric Walker come from, he wondered, and was there any more behind what he'd written? Billy shed every one of his player-type prejudices and adapted, Alderson said, whereas most of the people like him would have said, that's not the way we did it when I played. In answer to Billy's question, Alderson pointed to a row of well-thumbed paperbacks by a writer named Bill James, who had opened his eyes to a new way of thinking about baseball. Alderson had collected pretty much everything Bill James had written, including four books self-published by James between 1977 and 1980 that still existed only as cheap mimeographs. Sandy Alderson had never met or even spoken to Bill James. He wasn't a typical baseball insider, but he still recognized a distinction between people like himself, who actually made baseball decisions, and people like James, who just wrote about them. But he had found James's approach to the game completely persuasive, and had reshaped a professional baseball organization in James's spirit. That's why he had hired Eric Walker, in the hope of getting some Bill James-like stuff that was proprietary to us. For his part, Billy Beane had never heard of Bill James. But that was the big moment, he said, when I figured out that all the stuff Sandy was talking about was all just derivative of Bill James. His mind had finally found an escape hatch. It led to a green field as far away from professional baseball as you could get and still be inside the park. Chapter 4. Field of Ignorance. I didn't care about the statistics in anything else. I didn't and don't pay attention to statistics on the stock market, the weather, the crime rate, the gross national product, the circulation of magazines, the ebb and flow of literacy among football fans, and how many people are going to starve to death before the year 2050 if I don't start adopting them for $3.69 a month. Just baseball. Now, why is that? It is because baseball statistics, unlike the statistics in any other area, have acquired the powers of language. Bill James, 1985, Baseball Abstract. There is a certain kind of writer whose motives are ultimately mysterious. The writer born into a family of writers. The writer whose work is an attempt to make sense of some private trauma. The writer who, from the age of four, was able and willing to stay in his room and make up stories. Each of these creatures is a stereotype. What he writes may be good, but why he writes isn't something you particularly want to hear more about. The interesting case is a writer like Bill James. He grew up in a not unhappy family in Mayetta, Kansas, population 209, and the closest he came to an uprooting experience was the move from there down the interstate highway to Lawrence. There at the University of Kansas, James studied economics and literature. He didn't know any literary types, had no apparent role models, and was not encouraged in any way to commit his thoughts to paper. After a shaggy dog story in the U.S. Army, he was the last man from Kansas drafted to serve in Vietnam but never was sent, and a fruitless layover in graduate school, he found a job as the night watchman in a Stokely Van Camp pork and beans factory. It was while guarding Stokely Van Camp's pork and beans that James stumbled seriously into putting his thoughts down on paper, in response to having things he absolutely needed to say that he was unable to convey any other way. "Every form of strength is also a form of weakness," he once wrote. Pretty girls tend to become insufferable because, being pretty, their faults are too much tolerated. Possessions entrap men and wealth paralyzes them. I learned to write because I am one of those people who somehow cannot manage the common communications of smiles and gestures, but must use words to get across things that other people would never need to say. Even more oddly, everything James needed to say was either about baseball or could be said only in the context of a discussion of baseball. "I'd probably be a writer if there was no such thing as baseball," he said. "But because there is such a thing as baseball, I can't imagine writing about anything else." He was, from time to time, aware of the absurdity of devoting an entire adult life to the search for meaning in box scores. He never seems to have resisted his instinct to do it. "Now look," he wrote to his readers once he'd become an established, successful author, "both of my parents died of cancer, and I fully expect that it's going to get me too in time. It would be very easy for me to say that cancer research is more important to me than baseball, but I must admit that I don't do anything which would be consistent with such a belief. I think about cancer research a few times a month. I think about baseball virtually every waking hour of my life." James's first book was self-published, photocopied and stapled together by himself, and ran just 68 pages. Production budget? $112.73. Its formal title was 1977 Baseball Abstract, featuring 18 categories of statistical information that you just can't find anywhere else. To sell it, James took out a single one-inch advertisement in the Sporting News. 75 people found it alluring enough to buy a copy. Opening its pale blue cover, they found a short opening explanatory paragraph that failed to explain anything much, followed by 16 pages of baseball statistics. Astonishingly short and abrupt paragraphs followed by pages and pages of numbers. That was James's quixotic early approach to getting across what he had to say. Were it not for the author's frequent assertion that it was one, there was no reason to think of the first Baseball Abstract as a book. In this next section of this book, and there was certainly no reason to think that the writer had the capacity to lead the reader to a radical, entirely original understanding of his subject. What little James actually wrote in his first book felt stage-frightened. The questions he posed: do some pitchers draw bigger crowds than others? How much effect does an umpire crew have on the length of a game? Could not possibly have interested anyone but the nuttiest baseball nut, and in any case couldn't be answered confidently with the data James had from a single baseball season. It wasn't until the end of the 1977 Baseball Abstract that James offered his cocktail party-sized readership a glimpse of his potential. The topic that finally gets him sufficiently worked up that he devotes several entire pages to it of nothing but words is fielding statistics. The manner in which baseball people evaluate players' fielding performance, adding up their errors and applauding the guy with the fewest, struck him as an outrage. "What is an error?" he asked. "It is, without exception, the only major statistic in sports which is a record of what an observer thinks should have been accomplished. It's a moral judgment, really, in the peculiar quasi-morality of the locker room. Basketball scorers count mechanical errors, but those are a record of objective facts. Team A has the ball, then Team B has the ball. But the fact of a baseball error is that no play has been made, but that the scorer thinks it should have. It is uniquely a record of opinions. James went on to explain that the concept of an error, like many baseball concepts, was tailored to an earlier, very different game. Errors had been invented in the late 1850s when fielders didn't wear gloves. The outfield went unmowed and the infield ungroomed, and the ball was bashed around until it was lopsided. In 1860, a simple pop fly was an adventure. Any ball hit more than a few feet from a fielder on leave from the Civil War was unplayable. Under those circumstances, James conceded, it might have made some kind of sense to judge a fielder by his ability to cope with balls hit right at him. But a century later, the statistic was still being used, unaided by any other, when anyone with eyes could see that balls hit at big league players were a trivial detail in a bigger picture. A talent for avoiding obvious failure was no great trait in a big league baseball player. The easiest way not to make an error was to be too slow to reach the ball in the first place. After all, wrote James, you have to do something right to get an error. Even if the ball is hit right at you, then you were standing at the right place to begin with. The statistics were not merely inadequate. They lied. And the lies they told led the people who ran Major League Baseball teams to misjudge their players and mismanage their games. James later reduced his complaint to a sentence. Fielding statistic made sense only as numbers, not as language. Language, not numbers, is what interested him. Words and the meaning they were designed to convey. When the numbers acquire the significance of language, he later wrote, they acquire the power to do all of the things which language can do, to become fiction and drama and poetry. And it is not just baseball that these numbers, through a fractured mirror, describe. It is character. It is psychology. It is history. It is power. It is grace, glory, consistency, sacrifice, courage. It is success and failure. It is frustration and bad luck. It is ambition. It is overreaching. It is discipline. And it is victory and defeat, which is all that the idiot subconscious really understands. What to most people was a dull record of ephemeral events without deep meaning or lasting value was for James a safe deposit box containing life's secrets. Baseball was theater. But it could not be artful unless its performances could be properly understood. The meaning of these performances depended on the clarity of the statistics that measured them. Bad fielding statistics were like a fog hanging over the stage. That raised an obvious question. Why would the people in charge allow professional baseball to be distorted so obviously? The answer was equally obvious. They believed they could judge a player's performance simply by watching it. In this, James argued, they were deeply mistaken. That was James's most general point, buried beneath his outrage about fielding statistics. The naked eye was an inadequate tool for learning what you needed to know to evaluate baseball players and baseball games. Think about it. One absolutely cannot tell by watching the difference between a 300 hitter and a 275 hitter. The difference is one hit every 2 weeks. It might be that a reporter seeing every game that the team plays could sense that difference over the course of the year if no records were kept, but I doubt it. Certainly the average fan, seeing perhaps a tenth of the team's games, could never gauge two performances that accurately. In fact, if you see both 15 games a year, there is a 40% chance that the 275 hitter will have more hits than the 300 hitter in the games that you see. The difference between a good hitter and an average hitter is simply not visible. It is a matter of record. But the hitter is the center of attention. We notice what he does, bend over the scorecard with his name in mind. If he hits a smash down the third base line and the third baseman makes a diving stop and throws the runner out, then we notice and applaud the third baseman. But until the smash is hit, who is watching the third baseman? If he anticipates, if he adjusts for the hitter and moves over just two steps, then the same smash is a routine backhand stop, and nobody applauds. It was James's first sustained attack on baseball's conventional wisdom. He concluded it with a question. So if we can't tell who the good fielders are accurately from the record books, and we can't tell accurately from watching, how can we tell? By counting things, he replied. Then he went on to propose a new statistic. The range factor, he called it. A player's range factor was simply the number of successful plays he made in the field per game. There were obvious problems with range factors, too. An outfielder on a team staffed by fly ball pitchers, for instance, had more opportunities to make successful plays than an outfielder on a team staffed by sinker ball pitchers. But the details of the thing didn't matter. What mattered was James's ability to light a torch in a dark chamber and throw a new light on a dusty problem. He made you think. There was something bracing about the way he did it. His passion, his humor, his intolerance of stupidity, his preference for leaving an honest mess for others to clean up rather than a tidy lie for them to admire, that inspired others to join his cause. The cause was bigger than fielding statistics. The cause was the systematic search for new baseball knowledge. The cause wasn't original. James was hardly the first person to notice that there were still stuff to be figured out about baseball, and that the game's underlying rationalities might be discerned through statistical analysis. Going right back to the invention of the box score in 1845 and its subsequent improvement in 1859 by a British-born journalist named Henry Chadwick, there had been numerous analysts who saw that baseball, more than other sports, gave you meaningful things to count, and that by counting them you could determine the value of the people who played the game. But what got counted was often simply what was easiest to count, or what Henry Chadwick, whose reference point was cricket, had decided was important to count. Chadwick was the critical figure in this history. To anyone who asked, how could baseball statistics be so screwed up, Henry Chadwick was usually the beginning and occasionally the end of the answer. Chadwick's stated goal in counting the events that occurred on a ball field was reform. He wanted players to be judged by their precise contributions to victory and defeat. He was as upset about the immorality he witnessed on the baseball diamond as he was about the drinking and gambling he found on the city streets, about which he also never tired of complaining. He longed to affix blame and credit for baseball plays, and to do it, he grossly oversimplified matters. Fielding errors were just one example of Chadwick's moralistic mind at work. Another was his interpretation of the base on balls. In cricket, there was no such thing as a walk. Chadwick had to get his mind around a new idea. The tool was ill-designed for the task. Chadwick was better at popularizing baseball statistics than he was at thinking through their meaning. He decided that walks were caused entirely by the pitcher, that the hitter had nothing to do with them. In his initial box score, Chadwick recorded a walk as an error. Even in the later box scores, after he had listened to or at least heard the obvious objections from others, Chadwick never credited the hitter. He simply removed the walk altogether from the record books. "There is but one true criterion of skill at the bat," he wrote, "and that is the number of times bases are made on clean hits." Enter the batting average, ever since the chief measure of a player's offensive value. The more you examined these old measurement devices, the less apt they seemed. Chadwick, with help from others, had created a system of perverse incentives for anyone who trotted out onto a baseball field. The fetish made of runs batted in was another good example of the general madness. RBI had come to be treated by baseball people as an individual achievement. Free agents were paid for their reputation as RBI machines, when clearly they were not. big league players routinely swung at pitches they shouldn't to lard their RBI count. Why did they get so much credit for this? To knock runners in, runners needed to be on base when you came to bat. There was a huge element of luck in even having the opportunity, and what wasn't luck was, partly, the achievement of others. The problem, wrote James, is that baseball statistics are not pure accomplishments of men against other men, which is what we are in the habit of seeing them as. They are accomplishments of men in combination with their circumstances. The failure of baseball people to acknowledge that fact in their statistics led to exactly the sort of moral corruption Henry Chadwick, in creating them, had sought to eliminate. The many little injustices and misunderstandings embedded in the game's records spawned exotic inefficiencies. Baseball strategies were often wrong-headed, and baseball players were systematically misunderstood. Chadwick succeeded in creating a central role for statistics in baseball, but in doing it, he created the greatest accounting scandal in professional sports. Between Chadwick and James, there had been fitful efforts to rethink old prejudices. The legendary GM Branch Rickey employed a professional statistician named Alan Roth, who helped to compose an article under Rickey's byline in Life magazine in 1954 that argued for the importance of on-base and slugging percentages over batting average. A professor of mechanical engineering at Johns Hopkins, Earnshaw Cook, wrote two pompous books in prose crafted to alienate converts that argued for the relevance of statistical analysis in baseball. In the early 1960s, a pair of brothers employed by IBM used the company's computers to analyze baseball strategies and players. But the desire to use statistics to make baseball efficient, to measure and value precisely the events that occur on a baseball field, to give the numbers new powers of language, only became potent when it became practical. When Bill James published his 1977 baseball abstract, two changes were about to occur that would make his questions not only more answerable, but also more valuable. First came radical advances in computer technology. This dramatically reduced the cost of compiling and analyzing vast amounts of baseball data. Then came the boom in baseball players' salaries. This dramatically raised the benefits of having such knowledge. If we're going to pay these guys $150,000 a year to do this, James concluded in his essay on fielding, we should at least know how good they are, which means knowing how much they allowed in the field, just as much as it means knowing how much they created at bat. If this sounded compelling when baseball players were paid $150,000 a year, it sounded 100 times more so when they were paid $15 million a year. His first proper essay was the preview to an astonishing literary career. There was but one question James left unasked, and it vibrated between his lines. If gross miscalculations of a person's value could occur on a baseball field before a live audience of 30,000 and a television audience of millions more, what did that say about the measurement of performance in other lines of work? If professional baseball players could be over or undervalued, who couldn't? Bad as they may have been, the statistics used to evaluate baseball players were probably far more accurate than anything used to measure the value of people who didn't play baseball for a living. Still, had he left off writing in 1977, James would have been dismissed as just another crank who didn't know when to shut up about box scores. He didn't leave off in 1977. It didn't occur to him to be disappointed by a sale of 75 copies. He was encouraged. No author has ever been so energized by so little. As James's wife, Susan McCarthy, later put it, instead of one page of a stolen base study lying on top of a couple of pages of pitcher data in the dungeon of a Stokely Van Camp's cardboard box for years and years, ideas and questions about issues he had been chewing on for a long time took up residence in a climate that allowed for growth and maturation. An invisible subplot of baseball fanaticism is its effect on the spouses of the fanatics. Bill hid his interest in baseball when we first started dating, said his wife. If I had known the extent of it, I'm not sure we'd have gotten very far. In 1978, James came out with a second book, and this time, before entering his discussion, he checked his modesty at the door. The book was titled 1978 Baseball Abstract, the second annual edition of baseball's most informative and imaginative review. I would like to produce here the most complete, detailed, and comprehensive picture of the game of baseball available anywhere, he wrote, and I would like to avoid repeating anything that has ever been written before. Word had spread this time. 250 people bought a copy. To an author who viewed a sale of 75 copies as encouragement, the sale of 250 was a bonanza. James's pen was now an unstoppable force. Every winter for the next 9 years, he wrote with greater confidence. Every spring, his growing audience found relatively less space devoted to numbers and more to James's words. The words might run on for many pages, but they were typically presented as digressions from the numbers. Wishing to convey the history of his obsession with baseball, for instance, James buried it in a discussion of the year-end stats of the Kansas City Royals. Unable to control his distaste for the rich men who bought baseball teams and spent huge sums of money on players, he left off writing about the Atlanta Braves and picked up the subject of their new owner. Ted Turner, he wrote, seems never to have been tempted by moderation, by dignity, or restraint. He is a man who plays hard at gentlemen's games and whines when he loses that the victor was not a gentleman. No matter how hard he flees, he will always be pursued by an awful commonness, and that is what makes him a winner. Yankees fans would soon learn that James was capable of greater contempt. Turner is the man Steinbrenner dreams of being. The baseball abstracts were one long, elaborate aside, and the aside raised all sorts of strange new questions. If Mike Schmidt hit against the Cubs all the time, what would he hit? Did fleet young black players, as it seemed to James, actually lose their speed later in their careers than fleet young white players? Who were the best dead hitters? Even the most obscure questions about baseball and its history had practical implications. To calculate what Mike Schmidt would hit if he hit only against the Chicago Cubs, you needed to understand how hitting in Wrigley Field differed from hitting in other parks. To compare white and black speedsters, you needed to find a way to measure speed on the base paths and in the field. And once you'd done that, you might begin to ask questions about the importance of foot speed. To determine the best dead hitters, you needed to build tools to evaluate them, and those tools worked just as well on the living. That last problem preoccupied James. From his second season on, he more or less set baseball defense to one side and concentrated on baseball offense. He explained to the readers of the second abstract that his book contained roughly 40,000 baseball statistics. A few of them had been easy for him to obtain, but the bulk of them were compiled one by one, picked out of the box scores and laboriously sorted into groups of about 30 or so. Groups with titles like Double Plays Turned in Games Started by Nino Espinoza and Triples Hit by Larry Parrish in July. He freely admitted that it was, on the face of it, a bizarre way to spend one's time, unless one was obsessed by the baseball offense. I am a mechanic with numbers, he wrote to readers of the third abstract, tinkering with the records of baseball games to see how the machinery of the baseball offense works. I do not start with the numbers any more than a mechanic starts with a monkey wrench. I start with the game, with the things that I see there and the things that people say there. And I ask, is it true? Can you validate it? Can you measure it? How does it fit with the rest of the machinery? And for those answers, I go to the record books. What is remarkable to me is that I have so little company. Baseball keeps copious records, and people talk about them and argue about them and think about them a great deal. Why doesn't anybody use them? Why doesn't anybody say, in the face of this contention or that one, prove it? For what now seem like obvious reasons, the baseball offense was more interesting to James than the other two potentially big fields of research, fielding and pitching. Hitting statistics were abundant and had, for James, the powers of language. They were, in his Teutonic coinage, image numbers. literary material. When you read them, they called to mind pictures. Let us start with the number 191 in the hit column, he wrote, and with the assertion that it is not possible for a flake, I would hope that no one reading this book doesn't know what a flake is, to get 191 hits in a season. It is possible for a bastard to do this. It is possible for a warthog to do this. It is possible for many people whom you would not want to marry your sister to do this. But to get 191 hits in a season demands, or seems to demand, which is as good for the drama, a consistency, a day-in, day-out devotion, a self-discipline, a willingness to play with pain, and, to some degree, a predisposition to the team game which is wholly inconsistent with flakiness. It is entirely possible, on the other hand, for a flake to hit 48 homers. Hitting 48 homers is something done by large, slow men, three-quarters thespian. James was an aesthete, but he was also a pragmatist. He had happened upon something broken and wanted to fix it. But he could only fix what he had the tools to fix. The power of statistical analysis depends on sample size. The larger the pile of data the analyst has to work with, the more confidently he can draw specific conclusions about it. A right-handed hitter who has gone 2-for-10 against left-handed pitching cannot as reliably be predicted to hit 200 against lefties as a hitter who has gone 200-for-1,000. The offensive statistics available to James in 1978 were sufficiently comprehensive to reach specific, meaningful conclusions. Offense he could fix. He couldn't fix fielding because, as he had explained in his first abstract, there wasn't the data available to make a meaningful appraisal of fielding. Pitching didn't need to be fixed. Or at any rate, James didn't think it did. In 1979, in the third, now annual, baseball abstract, James wrote, "A hitter should be measured by his success in that which he is trying to do, and that which he is trying to do is create runs." It is startling when you think about it how much confusion there is about this. I find it remarkable that in listing offenses, the league will list first, meaning best, not the team which scored the most runs, but the team with the highest batting average. It should be obvious that the purpose of an offense is not to compile a high batting average. Because it was not obvious, at least to the people who ran baseball, James smelled a huge opportunity. How did runs score? We can't directly see how many runs each player creates, he wrote, but we can see how many runs each team creates. He set out to build a model to predict how many runs a team would score, given its number of walks, hits, stolen bases, etc. He'd dig out the numbers for, say, the 1975 Red Sox. Walks by individual players were still hard to find in 1975, thanks to Henry Chadwick, but team totals were available. He could also find out how many runs the 1975 Red Sox scored. What he needed to determine was the relative importance to the team's scoring of the various things Red Sox players did at the plate and on the base paths. That is, assign weights to outs, walks, steals, singles, doubles, etc. There was nothing elegant or principled in the way he went about solving the problem. He simply tried out various equations on the right side of the equal sign until he found one that gave him the team run totals on the left side. The first version of what James called his runs created formula looked like this. Runs created equals hits plus walks times total bases divided by at-bats plus walks. Crude as it was, the equation could fairly be described as a scientific hypothesis, a model that would predict the number of runs a team would score given its walks, steals, singles, doubles, etc. You could plug actual numbers from past seasons into the right side and see if they gave you the runs the team scored that season. James was, in a sense, trying to predict the past. If the actual number of runs scored by the 1975 Boston Red Sox differed dramatically from the predicted number, his model was clearly false. If they were identical, James was probably onto something. As it turned out, James was onto something. His model came far closer, year in and year out, to describing the run totals of every big league baseball team than anything the teams themselves had come up with. That, in turn, implied that professional baseball people had a false view of their offenses. It implied specifically that they didn't place enough value on walks and extra base hits, which featured prominently in the runs created model, and placed too much value on batting average and stolen bases, which James didn't even bother to include. It implied that sacrifices of any sort were aptly named, as they made no contribution whatsoever. That is, outs were more precious than baseball people believed or seemed to believe. Not all baseball people, of course. The Jamesian analysis was consistent with an approach to the game championed most vocally by the former manager of the Baltimore Orioles, Earl Weaver. Weaver designed his offenses to maximize the chances of a 3-run homer. He didn't bunt, and he had a special taste for guys who got on base and guys who hit home runs. Big ball, as opposed to small ball. But once again, the details of James's equation didn't matter all that much. He was creating opportunities for scientists as much as doing science himself. Other, more technically adroit people would soon generate closer approximations of reality. What mattered was A, it was a rational, testable hypothesis, and B, James made it so clear and interesting that it provoked a lot of intelligent people to join the conversation. The fact that the formulas work with the accuracy that they do is a way of saying that there are essentially stable relationships between batting average, home runs, walks, other offensive elements, and runs, wrote James. This kind of talk was catnip to people whose lives were devoted to discovering stable relationships in a seemingly unstable world. Physicists, biologists, economists. There was a young statistician at the Rand Corporation, a future chair of the Harvard Statistics Department, named Carl Morris. "I'd been thinking about advanced ideas in baseball analysis," said Morris, "and was impressed that someone else was too, who wrote about it in a very interesting way." Morris counted the days until the next baseball abstract appeared. James pointed the way to interesting questions that Morris could address more rigorously than even James could. There was also a bright young government economist with the Office of the Management of the Budget named Eddie Epstein. He stumbled across the abstract and decided he was in the wrong line of work. "I read the abstract," he said, "and the light bulb went off. I can do this." The way Bill laid out very clearly what could be gleaned from these mountains of baseball data. In the past, an awful lot was thought to be unknowable. Epstein began to pester Edward Bennett Williams, the owner of the Baltimore Orioles, for a job. Then there were the few hobbyists who had been active before James began writing his abstracts. Dick Kramer was a research scientist for the pharmaceutical company then called SmithKline French, now GlaxoSmithKline, and so had access to a computer. By day he used the SmithKline computers to discover new drugs, and by night he used them to test his own theories about baseball. For instance, Kramer had a hypothesis about clutch hitting. It didn't exist. No matter what the announcers said and what the coaches believed, Major League Baseball players did not perform particularly well or particularly badly in critical situations. On the one hand, it made a funny kind of sense. No one who behaved differently under pressure would ever make it to the big leagues. On the other hand, it contradicted the sacred, received wisdom in baseball. The sheer counterintuitiveness of his notion delighted Kramer. "It violates everyone's personal experience of pressure and how they cope with it," he said. And yet it was true, or impossible to disprove. Kramer had tested it and found no evidence that players hit differently in one situation than any other, with a pair of exceptions. Some left-handed hitters fared worse against lefties than righties, and some right-handed hitters fared worse against righties than lefties. Kramer's work has subsequently withstood intense, repeated critical scrutiny, but until Bill James came along, no one paid it any attention. "Until Bill came along," Kramer says, "it was just three or four of us writing letters to each other. Even my own family would say, 'This is a crazy way to spend your time.'" Kramer, like James, understood that the search for baseball knowledge was constrained by the raw statistics, and began to think seriously about starting a company to collect better data about Major League Baseball games than did Major League Baseball. One of the men to whom Kramer wrote letters on the subject was Pete Palmer. Palmer worked as an engineer at Raytheon on the software that supported the radar station in the Aleutian Islands that monitored Russian test missiles. At least, that's what he did for money. For love, he sat down with his charts and slide rule and analyzed baseball strategies. Both Palmer and Kramer had separately created their own models of the baseball offense that differed trivially from James's. Together, they later dreamed up the stat now widely used to capture the primary importance to offense of slugging and on-base percentages. OPS, an acronym for on-base plus slugging. Palmer really was a gifted statistical mind, and he had done a lot of work just for the hell of it that demonstrated the foolishness of many conventional baseball strategies. Bunts, stolen bases, hit and runs. They all were mostly self-defeating and all had a common theme, fear of public humiliation. Managers tend to pick a strategy that is least likely to fail rather than pick a strategy that is most efficient, said Palmer. The pain of looking bad is worse than the gain of making the best move. Palmer had written a book back in the 1960s revealing all this. The manuscript was still gathering dust on his desk when Bill James came along and created a market for it. In 1984, in the wake of Bill James's success, he was able to publish it, The Hidden Game of Baseball. Bill proved there were buyers for this kind of thing, Palmer says. I'm not sure the book would have seen the light of day otherwise. James's literary powers combined with his willingness to answer his mail to create a movement.
Research scientists at big companies, university professors of physics and economics and life sciences, professional statisticians, Wall Street analysts, bored lawyers, math wizards unable to hold down regular jobs. All these people were soon mailing James their ideas, criticisms, models, and questions.
His readership must have been one of the strangest group of people ever assembled under one idea. Before he found a publisher, James had four readers he considered celebrities. They were Norman Mailer, baseball writer Dan Okrent, William Goldman, the screenwriter, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, the guy who played Squiggy on the TV sitcom Laverne and Shirley.
James's readers were hard to classify because he was hard to classify. The sheer quantity of brain power that hurled itself voluntarily and quixotically into the search for new baseball knowledge was either exhilarating or depressing, depending on how you felt about baseball. The same intellectual resources might have cured the common cold or put a man on Pluto. Instead, it was used to divine the logic hidden inside a baseball game and create whole new ways of second-guessing the manager. 4 years into his experiment, James was still self-publishing his baseball abstract, but he was overwhelmed by reader mail. What began as an internal monologue became first a discussion among dozens of resourceful people, and then finally a series of arguments in which fools were not tolerated. Most witheringly not by James. Is baseball really 75% pitching? James J. Skipper attempted to answer this question in the 1980 Baseball Research Journal by the ingenious method of asking everybody in sight what percentage of baseball was pitching, totaling up their answers and dividing by the number of people in sight. By 1981, in response to a pile of letters asking him what he thought about a new baseball offense model created by the sports journalist Thomas Boswell, James was able and willing to write that the world needs another offensive rating system like Custer needed more Indians, or for that matter, like the Indians needed another Custer. What we really need is for the amateurs to clear the floor. There was now such a thing as intellectually rigorous baseball analysts. James had given the field of study its name, sabermetrics. The swelling crowd of disciples and correspondents made James's movement more potent in a couple of ways. One was that it now had a form of peer review. By the early 1980s, all the statistical work was being vetted by people, unlike James, who had a deep interest in and understanding of statistical theory. Baseball studies, previously an eccentric hobby, became formalized along the lines of an academic discipline. In one way, it was an even more effective instrument of progress. All these exquisitely trained, brilliantly successful scientists and mathematicians were working for love, not money. And for a certain kind of hyperkinetic, analytical, usually male mind, there was no greater pleasure than searching for new truths about baseball. It's like watching a soap opera.